The theories expressed are not the only possible interpretation. Viewers are invited to make a judgment based on all available information.
Everyone watching now, please share this link via the sidebar to any and all of your social media channels. This is important. Simply ask your friends and family to give us 15 minutes. That's all we ask.
Hamilton, my old-time friend, they put his face on the front of the tin. These are the dead presidents from the hood, and they represent the American dream for the average minority.
Ah, that's who's on the $10 bill, Hannibal?
Hannibal? Bear, oh my God. Burritos. He's a good guy. Mm-hmm. I think. We don't know, though.
I think he's sneaky. I know he is.
The hustler.
Yeah.
He is sneaky. That's why he talks fast and hard to understand. That's what people do. It's tricky. Like, Chris does that, too. Circle talk.
But then on top of that, but Hannibal, he's international because he knows multiple languages.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To notice that you're wrong than it is to prove that you're right. One of the things that you're supposed to learn in university is precisely that. It might be useful to listen to people that annoy you on the off chance that they know something that, if they tell you, you can use instead of dying. Talking to people who agree with what you say is like walking around in a desert. You already know everything that they say. The reason you're associating with them in that situation is so that they never say anything that challenges you, because you're afraid that if you go outside of what you understand, that you won't be able to tolerate the chaos.
Bingo.
Good. If you want, we can pick up at that quote. We don't have to take a break. Just pick up on that. I can comment on that.
That's back in action. So I've had a... Yeah. Good idea. I've had issues where I thought I was recording. So I've been collecting, I collect stuff over time, and I'll keep cutting pieces out, and I'm like, yeah, I want that one, and some of them. And sometimes, like, I just slip them in there, and they don't necessarily go with the show as much as I'd like it to.
Yeah.
But if I don't get it out there, you're right. It gets lost in translation somewhere in all the mess of stuff.
You know what I mean? Like, so you just cut out the part
that Yes.
You had to pee.
Huh. I have a few other questions and stuff.
Okay.
They go along. They might, you know, just kind of keep it going. It's probably... Yeah. And...
I'll do my best. You said I have an answer for everything, so now the pressure's on.
Well, I mean, we've talked about some challenges. And... Do you have any success stories?
My own or other people's?
Right. Well, like, of like... exemplary innovation and creativity, like,
you know, it's difficult for me, because if we're talking about myself, I've struggled a lot with finding, like, my own, I don't know, I guess you define success differently, but I didn't recognize that I had ADHD until like 2 years ago when I started learning more about it. Actually, my aunt passed away, and it made me think a lot, because she was one of the best people I have ever met, and I really, it was hard, because she was like such an outgoing person, and everybody loved her and all these things. And I'm not saying like I'm like her and everyone loves me, but the thing is that she had a lot of ambition, and she was held back by something. And like, we'd had conversations, you know, she had an ADHD diagnosis actually like a year before she passed away. And she finally got on medication, but it wasn't really like helping her yet, or she had other issues too, hoarding disorder and OCD and things like that. But it was actually kind of disappointing that she had passed away and I wasn't able to share with her all the things that I started to learn. And so it kind of catapulted me into learning more about ADHD and adults. And I realized that a lot of the things I had struggled with were due to those difficulties. And it's something where, like, I, of course, you have a period of, like, when you realize that you have ADHD, it's not like a life-threatening illness. It's just a it's just a different way of thinking. So I don't even think of it as a disorder, but it made me understand a lot about why I would start things and then not finish them.
It's efficiency and execution.
Yeah, it's literally an executive dysfunction, an executive function disorder. Okay, which I don't even agree with calling it a disorder, because I believe that, just like I said, we're tribal people, and there are people are useful no matter how they function, right?
Even if they swing on a vine like Tarzan?
You know, I would love to swing on vines like Tarzan. In fact, that sounds like a lot of fun, and maybe that's the ADHD. And
just wear a leaf.
The thing is that everyone's built differently, and the world is not necessarily built for people with brains like ours. And that doesn't mean that they're bad. It just means that I spent 33 years trying to fit myself into a box that wasn't right for me. And so that's why I have so much random experience in different things, because I've tried so many different things. And it's not trying and failing, it's trying and realizing that they're not a good fit,
right?
Or that there's always something that doesn't feel right. And when you actually do research on, like, adults with ADHD, you actually realize a lot of people are some of the greatest entrepreneurs that are famous and have done so well are actually people with ADHD. And you don't hear about that because it's not important necessarily, but it's important for us to understand that.
When you get in where you fit in.
Yeah.
It really can change everything, because things just run a lot smoother.
Yeah, and that's why I do so much better with the things I do now for work than when I was sitting at a desk under fluorescent lighting, just, you know, it's depressing when that's not what you're suited for.
Now, my next question, and I might want to rephrase it, but was, you know, how has technology influenced the way your industry operates? My question was going to be, do you think that technology, especially, you know, what we have today, like, do you think any of that plays a role into why there's the ADHD is so prevalent, especially amongst adults nowadays?
I mean, I definitely think that the infiltration of technology into our daily lives doesn't help. It definitely makes it, well, I'll say it helps and it hurts at the same time. So it depends on what we're looking at. Like, things like being able to talk into my phone and be like, hey, Siri, remind me that I have an appointment. Stuff like that helps people with ADHD. But as far as creating ADHD, I don't believe that it's created by technology. I think that it perpetuates some of the problems we have, because we have constant stimulation all the time, notifications, things like that.
I have a story.
But I don't think it's creating it. I think there's people that believe it's creating it, but I really believe one of two things. Either we are built this way naturally, or if you take some of the perspective from Gabor Mate, who's an expert on, he's a doctor who's expert on trauma, substance abuse, and ADHD. He worked in palliative care with dying people. There's, like, he's got tons of different experiences, and he's given some really interesting perspectives on ADHD. He actually has it himself, that he believes it's from early childhood neglect. Not like, you know, survival neglect, but like emotional neglect. Like, basically that in early childhood there was a development of hypervigilance and a lack of emotional regulation, because the child was in an unstable environment at a very young age. And that's why people believe that it's hereditary. And I don't know. That's one person's perspective that I found really interesting. It could be just that we're made that way, but certainly I didn't have the...
In the image of God.
God's got ADHD.
You might. You'd think if he's, you know, overseeing the whole world at the same time.
If you create the whole world in 7 days, like, I think you're neurotypical. I don't know.
We're trying to keep up with it all.
I don't know.
You kind of got out of hand. I think his little farm here.
Yeah. But yeah.
So I have a couple thoughts on that too myself. So I never had ADHD before the internet came out, and the internet wasn't even the so much as when the iPhone came out, when the smartphones came out. And I'll remember, because prior to that, like, I was really just, everything was smooth, efficient. Mm-hmm. And I noticed those changes when I look back on my life and I think about where difficulties and challenges came into play and things like started moving in, you know, not in the same direction or different direction, but just apart. Like everybody's minds were able to funnel into something different. Where before that it was like you had each other to, you know, or whoever, your team, your group, whoever you're working with, you're all of that same mindset, because without communication and being on the same page, like there was no other direction to go. Unless you'd have to call a lot of people to figure things out. And when the internet came out, you started having access to all these different perspectives on things. And I do believe though that more than one perspective can exist at the same time, coexist, you know, two people can have completely opposite truths for themselves, mm-hmm. and it can still exist.
Well, and that's why a lot of times ADHD and anxiety are cross-diagnosed, you know, either misdiagnosed or confused with each other. Same thing with bipolar disorder. Like there are different conditions that can have comorbidities, which means they are both diagnosable at the same time, or they can be misdiagnosed. So they can be confused.
Comorbidities? Is that like an ice cream?
Yeah, it's like Neapolitan of mental health disorders. but yeah, so it's basically, so you can have anxiety, right? And the anxiety can create ADHD-like symptoms,
right?
Such as distraction, emotional dysregulation, highs and lows, and that can be confused as bipolar. But you can have ADHD and have emotional dysregulation, and you can be anxious about the fact that you can't get shit done.
Right.
So both of them can be confused, and it's difficult because usually people with neurodivergent disorders are also emotionally dysregulated, and they have anxiety because, hell, if you can't get shit done because you can't focus, that's going to create anxiety.
My friend had put it to me a really good at one time, Isaiah. He says, you know, he's like, when I look to the past, I get anxiety. When I look to the future, I get anxiety. But when I focus on right here, right now, I just stop and I look at my hands, maybe I look at my finger pad, the prints on it. Mm-hmm. That's when I start, and I'm fine. He goes, I'm fine. I'm good. I'm breathing. I'm like, and everything's just good.
Well, that's why mindfulness practices,
bringing it back,
help people with neurodivergent disorders and anxiety to cope with those things. The problem is, it's kind of a cycle. It's kind of a, you know, vicious circle, because it's hard to relax into mindfulness if you're already anxious and your mind is going a mile a minute.
And that's where metaphysics really comes into play. Huge, like these affirmations and stuff. Now, affirmations aren't going to necessarily change your life, especially, you know, with the mode that we're in all day long. You know, you kind of almost have to be in a beta mode for the hypnosis aspect of it to, you know, for your subconscious to receive it and start to reprogram yourself. But just knowing certain things, like that's when I talk about things. I give thanks for my whirlwind of success. I am awake to my good and gathering a harvest of endless opportunities. I'm harmonious, poised, and magnetic. I'm irresistible magnet to all that belongs to me by divine right. Saying that stuff out loud overcomes all the thoughts in my head that never shut up. So
yeah, and it's really important for people to recognize that affirmations only work if your brain is able to internalize them as truth.
Yes, exactly, because the belief, so whatever it is that anyone believes out there that's listening here, anyone in the world, like everybody's belief is true for them. Whatever they believe, it's all true. Your perception is your reality. And I think, you know, everybody can have a different one. So if I believe something, it's true for me. Mm-hmm. But it's good to inspect those.
You have to actually believe it. And
yeah, you do.
The problem with affirmations that are like the ones that you listed are good because they're general.
General is very good.
And they are believable for the mind because they're more about opportunity than they are about yourself and your current state. So when you make affirmations about your current state and you don't actually feel confident in those affirmations, what it feels like to your subconscious is that you're lying.
Exactly. So they say, yeah, go general.
Work. It actually does the opposite effect. It actually makes you feel less confident because it's almost like you are reinforcing your disbelief in yourself, which sounds...
Because there's too much momentum going, right?
There's too much disbelief in the subconscious to reprogram it with something that is objectively false in the moment. So for example, if I say, my goal is to be a millionaire, right? And so I say to myself, I'm a millionaire. I know I'm fucking lying. Okay.
When you feel like giving up, don't. When you thinking about giving up, don't. When it look like you ain't gonna make it, keep going. When they tell you you can't, come on, man, who are they? When they tell you you're not gonna make it, don't believe them, man. Don't believe them. You got to be relentless. The harder the battle, the sweeter the victory. See, what you become in the process is more important than the dream. That's far more important. The kind of person you become, the character that you build, the courage that you develop, the faith that you're manifesting. Oh, it's just something that you get up in the morning, you look yourself in the mirror, you're a different kind of person. You walk with a different kind of spirit. And people know that you know what life is, that you have embraced life. You know it was hard, but you did it hard. When you feel like giving up,
because I'm not a millionaire, right? And I know that. So the issue with trying to manifest something like wealth, for example, you have to say something that is believable to the mind. So every day I am finding opportunities to build my wealth. Things like that, right? So where you're opening up your mind to the possibility of opportunity for those things, but you're not lying to yourself about your current state. Because sometimes we can think, okay, I'm gonna say affirmations that I'm this thing, or I am in this state, but I'm actually not.
Right, but if you think about, like, you know, my wallet has magnets in it. Like it magnetically attracts money, and it's just always crammed, jammed, stuffed full of things. Like you
what
feel
is it?
Well, so but you start picturing that, visualizing it, coming to it, and it's like, so then the other thing is, like, you know, money flows to me easily, often, from, you know, from both known and unknown sources. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, and picture yourself going to the mailbox and then, like, oh, there's a check in there, sweet.
But that visualization is different from affirmation.
Yes, it is. So that's how you get these things to stick, right? Because because there is a huge disconnect if you don't believe it. So these are ways to, I'm already looking for solutions without even saying that's what I was doing. But yeah, I'm always looking for a way to incorporate, because, yeah, there's a huge disconnect. And that's why affirmations don't work for very many people.
And it's not that affirmations don't work, but they have to be tailored to specifically what that person is able to believe about themselves. So they have to tailor it to... So, for example, Tony Robbins, when he was...
Where your energy goes.
Down and out.
Yeah, your focus goes.
Where focus goes, energy flows. Yeah. Exactly. And when he was down and out, had nothing, right? Working as a janitor.
He lives in Okeechobee.
Well, now he does.
Yeah. Okeechobee!
But at the time, like, when he was down and out, and all he had was a job as a janitor, and he would tell himself...
Custodian, I believe.
Oh, sorry, custodian. He would tell himself, every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better.
Yes.
And that is a affirmation that is believable for the subconscious, because it's, as long as you are a person that believes that you have the ability to improve, that's something your mind can believe. And so after you you use that affirmation, once you realize it's true, I'm getting better and better, then you can move more into the belief that you already are the thing that you want to be. But he also, so Jim Rohn, his mentor.
I know Jim.
I believe it was Jim Rohn who told him.
I love the way he talks
to keep, like, someone, I think it was Jim Rohn, told him to keep like three $100 bills in his wallet at all times. And so he would see it all the time. So that's the visualization part, where you see money in your wallet. And so seeing it creates the belief that, okay, I'm wealthy, I have money, right? And money's just, the reason I use the money example is because it's not that it's the most important thing, but it is a example that we can all relate to, the fact that, okay, money would make me more comfortable, so I am manifesting money in my life. So, and it's easy because it's quantitative and it's qualitative, the feeling of having that financial abundance.
You know what's all, to me, all that is, so there's the logical side of it, and then there's the spiritual side of it. You know, the mind is always trying to reason with everything. But when you really, when you go to the core of the matter within your own heart and you look at things, we were born here with nothing. We had nothing when we got here. And it's like, it's just really a matter of your spiritual flow on things. When you cut yourself off, when you do something drastic and that negatively affects somebody else, you're doing it to yourself. Mm-hmm. If you pour toxins on somebody else's garden, you're pouring them on your own. If you water their garden, you're going to water yours. So, and a lot of times, so when you have those blockages and stops, a lot of it's because you're having some sort of, something else is, it's external or it's all internal, a war with yourself or a war with somebody else. But,
well, part of that comes from the idea that we are separate from each other, which I know that's a little bit of a different topic, but the metaphysical idea that we are all one, and that what I do to somebody else is I'm doing to myself. I don't know, that requires a level of understanding.
It does.
That a lot of people have not reached yet, and so because of that, it's really hard for people to actually live that way.
I agree with that, and I think a lot of the older energy is with that. The newer like the younger, the youth, like they seem to be grasping these concepts easier. They're more awakened to these. But I do notice though that more and more people are becoming aware and awakened to this at a more rapid pace than ever before. Like there was a time when very, very few people were open to like any of these concepts, these new age thinking or whatever
it may be. Part of that is because religion has always pushed it out as something that is blasphemous. You know, organized religion, they've always been kind of like,
I grew up,
one side of my family was very religious, and if you even did yoga, you know, they'd be like, that's evil. It's crazy. Because, I understand that yoga has like, you know, spiritual roots, but it's nothing that's going to like cancel out your belief in a different belief system. So there's no reason why you have to reject things just because they're foreign to you, because ultimately the more you learn, you don't have to absorb others' beliefs, but the more we learn about different like spiritual traditions, the more we understand even our own faiths better, you know, the things that we grew up with, because I know that I have a very different understanding of like the Christian religion than I did when I did not learn about Eastern traditions or quantum physics. You know, before I understood all those things, I wasn't able to look at like, you know, passages from the text I learned about when I was a kid and realize that it has a different meaning than I was originally taught, which never actually made sense to me.
Agreed.
It never actually made sense to me. You kind of accept it because you're told you're supposed to. Right. But it's not that I dismiss that. Right. It's that I understand it on a different level now.
I remember them asking me, like, in Sunday school, do you believe Jesus died on the cross for your sins? I'm like, actually, no. And I'm like, I'm a little kid, but I'm like, everybody's saying yeah, and they're going around getting, you know, doing their little, and I'm like, getting their wine and taking their little piece of bread, and I'm like, but I'm gonna take it to fit in with these guys, but I don't know, because I don't really know the guy. Like, and that was my thing. Like, if I met him, maybe we talked, and I mean, he's like, "Hey, dude, like you know, yeah. man, you're just a little shit." But I'm like, I'm gonna right, right.
Yeah, it's you know, it's one of those things that you accept because it's what you're told you're supposed to. And I'm not saying that like, hey, don't believe in that. I'm saying like, if you explore other ideas, you'll actually understand that better. And like, I'm not here to tell anyone what to believe or that I'm right and they're wrong, because again, like, I don't know everything.
But it's kind of fun being right sometimes though, isn't it?
Well, every now and then, you know. it feels kind of warm and fuzzy when you're right, but like, we'll never know. That's the thing
about
spiritual stuff is we'll never know until it's too late to tell anyone. You know, if we ever find out,
right.
then we won't be able to tell anyone what the truth is. And that's fine. Like, I'm perfectly fine with knowing that I'll never be able to explain everything. All I can do is observe what we do have as knowledge, whether it's scientific stuff that's discovered, whether it's exploring other, like, you know, mythologies and traditions and spiritual beliefs. But ultimately, what the coolest part is, learning about new things will make you see the things you've already learned differently.
Yeah.
And we're always evolving.
Like hallucinogens.
I have not explored those. I'm a fairly sober individual.
Would I be lying if I said I hadn't either?
No, it's fine. I don't have any issues with all that. I just haven't, you know, like I said, I have control issues. So
no, right. I'm just saying that's something that can be, yeah. You know, I'm sure there's a whole audience out there that can relate to that.
Something to consider exploring. But, and maybe that, and I'm totally open to the idea that maybe that does broaden one's mind.
Well, they did a study in London at King's College, like on psilocybin. And like they said, they had a lot of positive reports and stuff that came out of that. And, you know, they have all these different medical reasons. Like, I don't know all of the information and have enough experience to, like, give enough feedback on that. But a lot of that stuff is accurate, though. I have enough experience to say it's accurate, but I don't have enough to say that it's all accurate.
I think ultimately, it depends on the mental state of the person doing it.
It certainly does.
Because, like, things like that can be administered in a medical setting or a spiritual setting in a traditional kind of ceremonial way that are a lot more effective than if someone just takes it on their own. Because if somebody just take, and it's not so much about whether they're taking it on their own than it is about their mental state at the time. Because people that take that kind of stuff recreationally, they believe that they're having a spiritual experience, and maybe they are. But if you're not prepared to understand what you're experiencing, I think
it's misunderstood. It can be trauma too.
It can be traumatizing. It can change their state in a way. It can actually trigger mental health disorders that were dormant.
Right, right.
It has been known to trigger schizophrenia in young people, like early 20s, which usually schizophrenia
comes like
on at that time.
Right. Maybe not such a good idea to do it so young like that. Like, let your brain develop and then, you know, I'm just saying, like, anybody who's out there curious about experimenting and stuff, it's not, what you said, though, is accurate, though. Like, it's not for, you have to be in the right.
It's not for everybody, and I think that we tend to have a very black and white view of most things, right? Because that's how humans tend to default, is to the black and white thinking. And thinking something is either good or bad. Like, the same thing with, like, THC, for example. I personally have never smoked THC. I took a gummy, like,
I did it, but I didn't inhale.
4 weeks ago with my... Okay, fine. But I took a gummy, like, 4 weeks ago. Didn't feel anything. Just bumped into some walls because I was, like, you know, kind
don't
of...
Don't you do that anyway?
Yeah, I do that. Like, it was even more so. But yeah, like, I didn't feel anything different, but maybe I took the wrong kind. I don't know. But I think that it's important for anyone who wants to experiment with hallucinogens. Like, I'm not coming from a place of experience myself, but having worked in mental health, I know that it can have negative effects. So, and not only that, but learn about spiritual concepts enough to where you feel that that's actually something you want to explore, and to where if you do have a spiritual type of experience, you know what you're dealing with. And you can understand more of what you're seeing or feeling or thinking in that experience, because it's not really gonna do you any good if you're just having this experience and you're feeling something but you don't really understand it. I think it's a combination of intellectual understanding and the feelings of it have to merge together.
Yes, when it resonates.
Otherwise, it's just, you just get high.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
You definitely have deep insight on a lot of this stuff. It's great. Which trends do you foresee shaping the future of your industry?
It's so funny. You keep saying industry, but I'm in so many different industries.
Well, but what we're talking about is something that you have, you know, vast knowledge on, and
I think that.
And it's applied in everyday life, right? That's one thing about psychology. Like, it never ends. Like, it is.
Well, that's what's interesting is that, you know, when I switched to studying psychology from things like marketing and business, I realized, like, I did it because I was interested in it, because I was bored with marketing, because it was just the same thing over and over again. And then when I switched to psychology, I learned less in school than I did just from general observation of behavior and working in social work. But I think I've learned more than anything about trauma and how trauma affects behaviors. And also the basic understanding of how people operate on a level of survival all the time. And they operate based out of fear the majority of the time. Even if they don't appear to be, there's always underlying fear like that. And so I think that as far as trends go, you know, everyone talks about social media now because it's such a big part of our life, but I have noticed that people are becoming more aware of not abnormal psychology in the sense of like diagnosable disorders, but more of social conflicts and particularly, like, you know that I talk about narcissism all the time, narcissism and codependency. And I think the reason why those topics are getting more exposure now is because through social media, we're able to connect more and share experiences. So things like narcissistic abuse.
I think to some degree, everyone has narcissistic tendencies in them. Mm-hmm. That, so for me, like, it's like, it's a, to me, it's like a overused word lately to me, but it's still a real thing, what you're saying. It's a very real thing. I just noticed though, like, I could like, every person, including myself, I'm like, I think about it, I'm like, well, we all saw narcissistic at times,
so,
to a degree, but there's some...
There is a difference between self-interest and narcissism. And I think that's where the confusion lies, is people saying that people are narcissists because they're interested in their own self-interest, their own self-preservation.
Like my stepdad.
everyone displays narcissistic traits on different levels. But the confusion is that narcissism is not self-interest. Because self-interest is natural, okay, in all of us. Again, we are all human beings surviving in a world that is basically always trying to drown us, you know? I mean, think about it from the perspective of, like, you know, a baby is born to parents which are supposed to care for them. And we rely on that support, right? And then as we grow older, we rely on ourselves more, but also on the support of others in the community. So ultimately, though, the only person, when you're an adult, the only person who's going to take care of you is you. So I don't think that self-interest is actually a problem as long as you still harbor empathy. Narcissism is where your survival instinct of self-preservation is trumps the empathy. So you actually, narcissists actually don't feel empathy in the same way that other people do. So say you're going to do something in your own self-interest, you might still consider the needs of others in your decision-making. That doesn't mean you're going to put others' needs over your own.
Right, but I pretty much always do, though.
But that can go the other direction, to where you're over-considering other people, and you're not actually living for yourself. And that's also a problem. So why we can't...
I've been told I'm too nice.
We can't pathologize self-interest, because self-interest is natural and it's important, right? Because the only person who's going to take care of yourself is you. So self-interest is not the problem. Lack of empathy is the problem, because there has to be a balance between serving yourself and serving others in a healthy way. If you're serving others more than you're serving yourself, it might actually be a codependency and self-abandonment problem.
Do you know, does anybody have it balanced their whole entire life from cradle to the grave? Or does everybody eventually go through cycles of...
It takes a very balanced and healthy childhood to actually achieve that, and I think it's very rare.
I think it's very rare, too.
Which is why I don't think the term narcissist is overused. I actually think it's more common than we understand.
I mean, it just felt like it to me, because it seems like I kept hearing it everywhere I was turning, but maybe that's the algorithms and how they present information.
I think it's the algorithms, and I also think it's spreading like wildfire, because people are finally...
Figuring it out, realizing it.
People are finally finding a label for something they've been experiencing for a long time.
Yeah, it's true, though, because there's a lot of damage that goes on with that stuff, too.
I know that for me, it was eye-opening when I actually understood what I was dealing with in various different relationships in my life, between, you know, one of my parents having narcissistic traits and a personality disorder, being in relationships with people that were either high grade or low grade narcissists. Like, there's different grades of it too. It's not like people either have no empathy or too much empathy. It can be just the fact that people, and so it's narcissism is rooted in insecurity. Which is, again, why I think insecurity is the biggest plague in our society.
Right. And then it's really interesting to me, because if I'm doing anything, if I was being narcissistic, for example, or anything that I was doing that was out of line, I want to be called out on it. I want to be told so that I can, you know, and I want to be...
Which makes you not a narcissist.
I want to be called out on it all the time. Like, if it takes that for me to constantly course correct to try to do better, because obviously I don't want to hurt the people around me, so I don't want
to
be...
But that, by definition, makes you narcissist.
So there's that aspect of it, right? But then if somebody's telling me that, though, I don't look at it and get mad. I mean, I'm like, shit, like, I might for a moment, but I don't hold on to it. Like, I notice some people, like, when you try... I'm somebody who's huge into feedback, so, like, I want it, so that's how I show my love. Like, I'm always giving feedback to people. And I notice, too, like, it doesn't seem that... Like, not everybody's always so receptive of it, or they'll take it, you know, like, taking it personally or getting down on themselves about something. It's like, no, this is an opportunity for you know what I mean? So that you can see what it is that...
But think of it this way, okay? If you are... You may have insecurities, because I believe we all have a certain level of insecurities, because, again, it's very rare that we have such a secure childhood that... We are able to...
I got pretty lucky.
I did. I mean, and some of us are better.
It could have been... Don't get me wrong. It had its issues too, and it could have been better. But I was pretty lucky.
Yeah, and so for that reason, you have enough self confidence to be able to take the feedback. But try to think of it from the perspective of somebody who does not believe that they're capable of growth. if you didn't believe in your capability to grow as a human being, so much so that you actually had to suppress that very thought. Okay. The level of shame and guilt that narcissists feel is so deep that they're actually unable to recognize it, because the shame would be so strong that they wouldn't be able to survive it emotionally. It would send them into a spiral.
Have you ever heard of the Mental Illness Happy Hour with Paul Gilbert?
No.
Really? Mm-hmm. Oh my God. So anybody listening out there, I really honestly, or you know, recommend that you check it out. I remember, I don't know if the cover is still the same as it was, but it was like an old station wagon with these it was a cartoon drawing with this oversized pill prescription bottles like tied down around the car. And he's like, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a licensed therapist, you know, just picture it more like a waiting room for that doesn't suck, and everybody's sitting around talking about their issues and stuff. Yeah. And he's got shame and something survey, like he does, mm-hmm. shame and secret survey that he has out there. People fill it out on his site and then he reads them on the air. And it's like, holy, just when I thought my life was fucked up at different points and stuff, I'm like, man, I had it pretty freaking good. Like, you're hearing what the shit people, and like, you know, people are just talking about their fantasies or their darkest. It's like, whoa.
Have you ever heard of Post Secret? I have two Post Secret books. And it's, some of them are really funny and some are really sad. And it's basically, I don't know if they still create these, but it's a book which is printed compilations of postcards that are anonymously sent in that say people's deepest, darkest secrets. And some of them are hilarious. Like they're like, I made deer's hump, and it shows like a picture of people doing the Christmas deer, like the deer in the fire, and they're like making them hump, right? And then there's others that are like talking about sexual assault and things like that are like really right? And so it's interesting, and it's like, I kept these books because I'm like, this is so interesting how people, basically, they're sending these in anonymously.
I would love to read that on the air.
Yeah, I mean, I can bring it to you, but some of them are just so sad.
They are, and that's the thing. Like when you're very empathetic, like he is too. Like he's like, wow. He's like, wow. Like I can hardly hold back the tears right now. Or he's feeling for these people like in different ways, and just like, because he had a lot of fucked up things going on with him too, and then. It's nice to know that you're not alone sometimes in this world when it comes down to things. And that's why I feel like a lot of the things that I talk about too, like even when I do let my emotions out, and if they do get at like where you're not supposed to, but it's like, I know a lot of men out there want to. I know a lot of them want to cry at certain times where they don't feel like they can, or they want to, you know, express themselves in certain ways. The deal is those, not going overboard with them or dealing with it is so long, but eventually it's all going to pass. You know, you do what you got to do, but eventually, hopefully by letting that stuff out, it can actually help you grow and better yourself.
Well, and that's the feedback I've gotten from some people who have opened up to me, like males who have problems with that, where they're like, I can't talk about this with other guys. Because there's an even stronger sense of shame in men who have histories of sexual assault, for example. Like, that's not something men talk about, even though it sometimes haunts them. Or just their relationship with their dad. They have a terrible relationship with their dad, and it ruins their life. And they can't have relationships with other men, or they can't have relationships with women because they weren't given good examples of that. And there's so many things like that that then make them feel inadequate in various different ways. And then it comes out as this insecurity that then makes them question every encounter they have because they don't feel
right.
Whole and like enough.
and we have over 7 billion people on the planet because everybody was, you know, humping like rabbits, not thinking about the consequences of what you're gonna, like, there's a time when you needed all those the extra children to help out around the farm or whatever it was, where, and then there came a time where that stuff started fading away and people were still having a lot of kids. What do you do with them all? How do you keep them all busy? And the parenting aspect of it, I think people that have children should really want to. They should really be thinking ahead of time. You can't really stop it, what's the procreation of what's going on out there in life. But if people had a better, you know, a more thoughtful mindfulness to the whole thought process of having the children and how they would handle the things, I mean, you could stabilize a lot more situations.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of people who are having children don't actually understand that having children is more than just keeping them alive and, you know, disciplining them. Like, we have a perception of discipline that's like, well, I just need to get them to do what I want them to do. And that's not enough, because unfortunately, like, so conditions like narcissism, which is really a, like, again, a spectrum, but it's developed by this combination of, there's different ways that people can get to that state, but the insecurity is developed by, like, a combination of overindulgence of, like, meeting people's children's needs, like their physical needs or their wants, and giving them, like, the deriving this sense of entitlement in them, but also at the same time underindulging things like emotional support and their ability to self-soothe. So if you take away a child's, or you don't teach a child how to self-soothe, they're going to, their frustrations are going to come out in ways that are unhealthy. And that's where you see, like, conflicts where they're trying to settle their emotions in ways that are not productive. And a lot of the time it comes off in blaming others because they're so afraid that if they admit fault to something that they're bad. So even when you tell a kid, like, you're bad, you're a bad boy, you're a bad girl.
Should explain it to him. Why?
Yeah, like, so...
What exactly is it that brought us to this point right here, right now? And, you know, this is just a behavior that I'm upset with.
Yes,
it's nothing about you as a person.
The behavior as separate from the human.
I used that when I with employees, like, and I do remember building super teams too. Like, when you have to take them back, it was the 1 minute manager is what, I don't know if you ever heard of that book, but it was great. But it just talked about 1 minute reprimands and 1 minute praising and the order that you do it in. So you know, you got to tell them all the crap that's going on, but then you got to build them back up again. You got to, like, let them know that it is, there's a huge difference. This is a behavior. This has nothing to do with how I feel about you, this person. I love you.
Yeah,
like,
and,
I, but
that's and, how you develop.
And it works so good. It works so good. It was the best. And you need to do that with your children. Mm-hmm. People need to separate that and not take a little bit more time with them.
Yeah, because otherwise you have this, this skewed identity that if I do something bad, that means I'm bad. And, like, intellectually we understand, most of us understand that we are not our behavior, but there are actually people that don't understand that. And when you put
Michael Jackson had an album called Bad.
Yes, it's very good. It's very good, actually. I'm a big fan. But when you try to tell someone that, like, they equal their behavior as when they're young, they will develop a belief that if someone addresses their behavior in a critical way, that they're saying that they're bad. And I've experienced that in relationships, and I didn't understand what exactly I was dealing with at the time, but I would say, like, hey, when you did this, this hurt my feelings. And to me, that is a productive way of communicating. But to a person who's insecure...
I think so, too.
But to a person who's insecure, they see it as, well, you don't like me, and I'm bad, and if you don't
right,
like,
right.
If you don't like what I did, you can just kick rocks.
Crux. I just heard that on a song. I'm like, that's what they say in this song. Like,
go
funny.
On down the boulevard.
Right.
And it's like, okay, but I'm just addressing this behavior. But they'll take it personally because they identify their identity with their behavior. And I would try to explain, it's just the behavior I'm addressing.
And some people can't even explain it to them. There's not enough crayons in the world to, like, even if you do, like, they'll still take it that way. And that's where it really gets tough when they got such embedded beliefs that they can't.
But that's because they truly identify their behavior with who they are. And yes, our behavior, our consistent behavior does shape who we are, but your past behavior does not mean you have to continue that behavior. So, but that,
right.
That requires a level of confidence where you believe that you can change your behavior. And if
right.
you don't believe that, then you're going to take criticism of your behavior as a personal insult.
But then I look at, there's a quote I heard a long time ago. If our past had any, I think it was Jim Rohn actually, if our past had anything to do with our future, we'd all be in trouble, he says.
Yeah, but if you're not able to reach that level, and that's why it's so difficult to overcome later in life, because we already have ingrained beliefs. It's not impossible, but it requires someone to have a certain number of experiences that are positive, that do show they're able to change, to build that confidence.
So, and I don't know if you're aware of this or not, this might be, this kind of takes us off the subject a little bit, but did you know that our universe is in a different part of the galaxy than it used to be? And it moved there, and we have different light spectrums right now than we ever did. And so the information that comes to us, where your body, your DNA uploads and downloads information, you know, just as light in general, because that every, you know, that's what everything is, that now things are so rapid, like the information's coming at us more rapid, everything is moving so rapid, so is manifestation. So fears you're noticing, I noticed it too when the stage, so I don't know if you've heard of this or not, but you know, there was time capsules that apparently our starseed families had brought here to Earth and planted their DNA capsules, and they opened up different timelines, and not all at once, but I think they're pretty much all open right now, or they're working on it, where it's upgrading your DNA. With that comes this crazy manifestation that goes faster. So I remember when all this was kind of going on, and I remember all of a sudden, I lived in a small town where it was pretty quiet. You'd rarely ever hear sirens. And when that stuff started going on, and I want to say it was probably around 2014, 15, something like that. Maybe it was 12. it was the release of all this, where the harmonic balance of the earth, I mean, everything's being recalibrated. And the sirens, all of a sudden I noticed they were on every day. You could hear the ambulance every single day, and the fire trucks and the cop cars, and every day. And it's like, and it never stopped, and it kept going and going. Well, so if you're a hypochondriac, for example, and you think there's something wrong with you all the time, people are inducing heart attacks and all kinds of shit going on. Your fears are really manifesting at a rapid rate. Same thing though with the Getting Better and Better Club. If you're thinking that you're going to get better and better, you will be getting better and better and better, and there's no end to it. People think that, oh, I'm getting older, I have degenerative disc disease, or I got, this is going out on me. That's bullshit, because your body produces new cells every single day. It doesn't produce old cells, it produces new ones. Your body's always in this constant state of regeneration, and you can actually, you know, prolong a lot of things just by having a different mindset about it. And I'm noticing that in myself. I've been getting in the better and better club. Like, even my own body has been getting more and more physically fit over time.
Well, and even the people that believe that they have to physically do something to get better, if you believe that, then you will seek opportunities to do that. So, for example, I work at a wellness studio, and we have people that come in and they use our wellness services. And of course, if they believe that they're going to get better, they're going to see better results with those things than the people who don't believe they're going to be better. And at the very least, the people who believe they're going to get better are going to seek out those things. And it requires a level of belief to even experience those benefits. because if you're always telling yourself, well, this isn't going to work, usually the people that don't really believe it's going to work or they're just dabbling in it, they don't see the most results. So people who come in really believing that they're going to receive a benefit from it, they experience.
And what did Henry Ford say? Whether you believe you can or you believe you can't, you're right.
Yeah, because belief has so much to do with
right.
results. And that's it. Even if you look at it from a religious perspective, for people who like do, you know, ascribe to that, there's, you know, like the whole, if you have faith, things will, you have to have faith to, like even the concept of prayer, right? The reason that prayer works is not because you're, well, my belief is, it's not because you're asking for something and a magical bearded man in the sky is going to give it to you. It's because you believe it's going to happen. So even if you look at those concepts, it's not that you know, prayer is bullshit. It's that the belief aspect is what actually makes it.
And the belief is the heart part where it actually, that's what takes that, the mind, the thoughts, and the belief is what makes it cognitive, right? It actually brings it together and formulates like, ooh, that's why it's going to work. Apparently they took that out of the Bible. It was in the Book of Thomas that they discovered down the road where they're like, wow, so where the mind, that's where, and the same thing where two or more agree, because when you agree, it shall be done, right?
Which sends off a vibrational
frequency. Because we're both thinking that's going to happen now. So, and the more, right, and you get enough people, you get a big circle of people thinking the same thing, can really change the energies and the probabilities of things.
And that's why, like, there was I don't remember when exactly it was done, but there was like a group of monks who came into, I wish I could remember what city it was. They came into a major city.
Tibet.
I don't know.
7 years.
No, I think it was in the U.S. And the crime rate actually went down.
Oh, I bet.
During that period of time that this large group of monks came to that center and the vibration or the prayer,
sure,
or whatever it was that they were doing actually lowered the crime rate during that period.
And then when we think of quantum physics to add into that with that, so then you're taking the aspect of parallel realities, parallel universes, and the Mandela effect where things can actually change,
mm-hmm,
for the state that you're in. It's a very interesting concept for sure.
I was just going to look up that.
Yeah, you go right ahead.
Sure, I'm really curious.
Do you think there's any upcoming?
So it's an article in the New York Times. So this was dated August 1st, 1993. This particular article is at least, I don't know when it happened. Hold on. So basically, it's quoted as being a larger level of consciousness. So there was this group of, it says more than 4,000 practitioners of transcendental meditation, including more than 12 Long Islanders, went to Washington on a 6-week mission to slash the crime rate in neighborhoods like one in Washington. Let's see.
They were successful. That sounds, you know, that sounds like a good mission.
The group say violent crime dropped 23.6% in the first 4 weeks.
Wow. That's huge.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a good mission, like something to, you know, try to put a group together of and fight for certain causes like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you get everybody on, you know, I would think that if they're going to join, they're probably on the same page, so when your efforts are all working together.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cumulative effect of...
That's what I was going to say, the cumulative effect. Mm-hmm. You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Weird.
So yeah, it's interesting how, like you said, multiple people agreeing on something, or just, you know, the concept of prayer in general, the belief system, and that's why it's like, no one can make change unless they really believe that they can, and which is the reason why you can't make other people change, because it's not going to happen unless they, one, believe it can and they really want it to.
Jim Rohn had also made it, maybe it was Zig Ziglar, made a comment about when somebody makes up their mind, it's made up, like they're not going to change it. Like, it's like in sales, for example, like, you know, they're not going to change it unless you present new information.
Yeah.
That they would be open to receiving, first of all, but it's new information. So then they get to reformulate a new thought on it. But but up till now, all the information they have, they're not changing their mind. So you actually have to bring something new to the table, a different strategy. I'm kind of that kind of person that Adam says to me, he's like, yeah, I like how you do that. He's like, you just throw enough shit up against the wall, something's gonna stick.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because new information doesn't always change people's minds.
No,
there seems to be a limitation to people's systems changing based on what they currently believe. So you have to introduce new information, but it has to have enough in common with the person's current belief system to be able to integrate.
Finding common ground.
Because if you bring something completely new in that doesn't migrate well into their current belief system, it's not gonna work. Which is why I always approach spiritual concepts from the perspective of the person. And this is the benefit of understanding various different spiritual concepts, understanding science and how they relate, because I can talk to someone who is a devout Christian, a Buddhist, or an atheist.
If you look at anybody's vision board, you know what's on it? Beach houses and $1 million and a Maserati, the finishing line at the New York City Marathon, and all the things that you hope and dream for. And the reason why that's a huge mistake is that if the only thing that is on your vision board is the thing that's going to take you 10 years to get done, as you sit here in your studio apartment or in the spare bedroom of your parents' house at a desk in the corner and you stare at a $10 million beach house, oh my God. That is going to feel so far away. Instead of that vision board keeping your dreams front and center, that vision board is rubbing them in your face. It's not motivating at all. Why? Manifesting is not just hoping and wishing. Manifesting is training your mind, body, and spirit to do the work to make that beach house a reality. You need to start visualizing the hard, the scary, the irritating steps that are going to get you there. That's what you're going to put on the vision board.